Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Verse 4 of Numbers 21. It says as follows, they travelled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no bread, there's no water. We detest this miserable food. Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people and many Israelites died. And the people came to Moses and said, we've sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray the Lord will take the snakes away from us. So Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said to Moses, make a snake and put it up on a pole. And anyone who's bitten can look at it and live. So Moses made a bronze snake. He put it up on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived. I wonder whether in a minute you can welcome our, it's not so much a guest speaker because he's part of the church, but Joel Wade has never preached before here at least. Joel and Dee have been, Dee Atkins have been right at the heart of the multiplication of a whole load of young professionals or young adult connect groups over the last couple of years. We've really enjoyed watching God's hand on him in that setting. We're looking forward to hearing him preach. So I wonder whether you give him a warm welcome as he comes now to preach to us.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Dave. good morning. For those of you who don't know me, as Dave said, I'm Joel. I co-lead one of the Young Adult Connect groups here at Christchurch. And just so you learn a little bit about me, I'm a graphic designer. I work for the Daily Telegraph newspaper. I've lived in London for about 3 years now. I live down in East Dulwich in South London. And part of my vision and the vision for our Connect group, the Young Adult Connect group, is to see young people, to see my generation flourish in this city, to see Jesus for who he is, and to see their lives fulfilled and through the plan and call that he has for them. And it's a real privilege to be able to speak to you this morning. And one of the things I first wanted to know, obviously, when I was asked to speak, was what passage or what topic am I going to be given? And I knew it was going to be on Moses, so I thought, you know, it's my first time. They'd give me the Red Sea or maybe the Ten Commandments or you know, one of those classic stories. But nope. I get a load of snakes killing a bunch of people in the middle of the desert, and I'm sure it's one of those stories that parents read to their children before they go to bed. So thanks very much, guys. That's great. And I've got to say at the outset that I absolutely hate snakes. I had nightmares about them as a kid, so it was a real pleasure to be able to dwell and think about the significance and meaning about snakes for hours and on end. It was a real joy. Although I'm not alone, of course. Indiana Jones famously hates snakes, and my reaction to getting the story was a little bit like his. Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes? So along with his rugged good looks and quick fire wit, that's just one of the other many comparisons I have with the great adventurer. The quotes get better, don't worry. Now, I'm sure a lot of you will be familiar with the story, and I'm sure a lot of you won't be. And I've got to admit that when I reread this story, I found it a little bit strange. But like so many other times in the Bible and so many other stories, I was surprised at how much God can use the seemingly strange and weird stories to not only teach us something, but also say something about Jesus and who he is. And I don't know where some of you will be on your journey, but I think for maybe some of us who are exploring Jesus or trying to find out what his purpose was here on earth, I think this passage can surprisingly teach us something about him. So let's remind ourselves where the Israelites are at this point. They're still walking through the wilderness, trying to get north to what will be Israel, to the promised land. And they've got to go through a country called Edom. And Moses asked the ruler of Edom, this is before the passage, he asked the ruler of Edom whether they can travel through. And the ruler of Edom says to Moses, if you try to come through Edom, we will kill you. So it's quite clear, but Moses kind of heard that and thought, oh, maybe I can, you know, renegotiate with this guy. So he asks again, and this time, not only does he say no, but he brings out his armies before the Israelites, which was much larger than Israelite army, and says, Moses, we will literally kill you. You can't come through Edom. And this is where we get to the story of the bronze serpent. And I want to focus on the first two verses initially. And this, I'll just reread them. It says, they traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no bread, there is no water, and we detest this miserable food. And the first thing I want to note from this passage is, just like the Israelites, sometimes God takes us the long way round to reach our promised land. And the very root and reason why this story is even here is because the Israelites are complaining that they've got to take the long way rather than the short one to get to their promised land. And I think for most of us, when we feel like we want something, or maybe we feel like God's even promised us something, we can complain just like the Israelites, and we can grow impatient just like the Israelites. But why? Why does God take us the long way around just as he did with the Israelites and Moses? And why does he not give us the things that we want and desire as quickly as we'd like? And I think we can learn something from this story, because we know that because of Edom's refusal to let them travel through, they've got to take quite a significant detour. And when you think of the years they've already been traveling through the wilderness, it's easy to understand why the Israelites would grow impatient. But we also know what would have happened if they travel through Edom. They would have faced armies that they couldn't overcome and battles that they could not win. And Moses and God knew what would have happened to the Israelites if they traveled through Edom. And yet the Israelites, they still complain. And some of those Israelites, they may have had no idea what was waiting for them had they traveled through. And I kind of think that's true of some of us as well. Have you ever felt like God was taking you the long way round to get to your promised land? Maybe you're waiting for God to give you that job that you've always dreamed of, or maybe it's the relationship that you're longing for. Or maybe, like the Israelites, you're just wanting to move somewhere better, to move somewhere new. And perhaps God is leading you that way for a reason. And we have no idea what is waiting for us if we got the things we want, or if we went by a quicker route. We do not know what battles we would face if we went the way we think we should go. And perhaps God is leading us the long way around because we don't have the strength to win the battles we'd face. And sometimes God takes us around Edom rather than through it, because we have no idea what is waiting for us. And I find it amazing that the Israelites, they even look back on their time in Egypt, and they kind of start questioning the motives of God in leading them out of slavery. And in essence, the people of Israel weren't trusting that God knew best. And I wonder if that's true of some of us too, because it can certainly be true of me. And I find it ironic that one of the complaints that the Israelites make is about the food. And in the ESV version of or translation of the Bible, they say, oh, there is no food, and we hate this food. Doesn't really make sense. And it reminded me of this YouTube video I watched once, you may have seen it, of this guy who buys a pizza from Asda, and he's from this town called Merthyr Tydfil, which has no relevance, but it's a funny name. He buys this pizza from Asda, and he takes it back to his house, and he looks at it, and he realizes that there's no topping. And it's like, how do you forget a topping on a pizza? That's crazy. And he phones up the complaints department in Asda and says, there's no topping on my pizza. What are you going to do about it? And this guy who works with, I presume, the complaints department and Asda, is kind of saying, oh, we're so sorry about that. That's terrible. I have no idea how this could have happened. We'll open up an investigation to find out the reason. Which sounds a little bit strong, but fair enough. And this guy, he's not satisfied. He's like, well, what am I going to do now? I've got to walk all the way back into town to buy some more dinner. You know, what am I going to do about my dinner? You've got to go and order me a pizza. You've got to deliver me a new pizza. It's quite unreasonable, although I probably would be the same. And then what happens next is kind of one of these moments where I wish I was in that kitchen with that guy, because he kind of goes a bit quiet and you just hear this, oh. And I wish I was there to witness him slowly turn round the pizza to reveal the American hot facing him with the little circles of pepperoni staring him in the face like judgmental eyes, saying, you're too stupid to eat me. You don't deserve this beautiful pizza. He'd obviously been looking at it the wrong way around. I don't know how you do that. And to justify his stupidity, he even says that I think they should have a this way up sign on the box, just so everyone's clear which is the right way up and which is the wrong way. It's crazy. You should watch the video. It's hilarious. But like that pizza guy, the Israelites were blinded by their complaining. And as a result, they couldn't see that God had provided them with the very thing that they needed at that point. And as Chris said a few weeks ago, God's got the people out of Egypt, but he wanted to get Egypt out of the people. And for a lot of those Israelites, Egypt was their home. It's where they were born. It's where all their life experience would have been. And I know they were slaves and it would have been terrible, but they'd have had very little knowledge what the world was like beyond the borders of Egypt. And now they're just walking in the wilderness. And I'm sure some of them are thinking, man, is this ever going to get any better? There'd have been no holidays and just, yeah, they would have had no idea what the world was like outside of Egypt. And I think when you think about the length of time that Israelites would have been in Egypt, I'm almost certain that lots of their customs and beliefs and practices would have kind of weaned their way into the Israelite culture. And yes, they'd left Egypt, but Egypt hadn't left them. And perhaps this journey is another opportunity for God to start to deal with some of the disobedience in their hearts, to remove some of those beliefs that they picked up in Egypt. And in lots of ways, the whole Bible story is a story of going the long way around. Thousands of years went by before Jesus came to earth, and thousands of years have gone since. And perhaps to God, the journey is just as important as the destination. And as I said earlier, I'm currently working as a graphic designer, and it would be really easy for me to stand here and say, God's led me to this point, and I never doubted him for a second. I knew exactly what I was doing. I trusted in him wholeheartedly. But that wouldn't be the complete truth, because when I was leaving school, I was kind of figuring out what I wanted to do as a career, what degree to study, and there was quite a lot of pressure from my school to make a decision, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. I had literally no clue, and I was praying to God that he would give me some kind of sign that, you know, maybe I'd wake up in the middle of the night with a scalpel and be like, oh, doctor. Never happened. And I was trying to take the it's a good job I wasn't a doctor. That'd have been terrible. But that never happened, and I was trying to take the responsibility or the decision off my own shoulders and kind of put it onto God. And I started to kind of just do a few odd things, and I did a music course for a year in Brighton, then I moved back home and was a painter and decorator for a year. Then I started teaching a bit in schools, the drums a bit, and it was a bit sporadic, and all those things were really good, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. It wasn't what I wanted to kind of give my life to, and I knew that I had to trust in God, but I really doubted that he was leading me. And I felt like I was walking in the wilderness in those 3 years. And I didn't even know what the promised land even looked like. I suffered so much worry and anxiety because I just wasn't trusting God. I wasn't trusting that he had a plan. But then through small steps and conversations, I did eventually make a decision. And I studied graphic design, and at the age of 24, moved to London and got my first job. And as I said, there were so many points on that journey where I suffered unnecessary anxiety and worry because I didn't know or didn't trust in God that he knew best. And even though it felt like I was taking the long way round, I can stand here and look back at that time, at those 3 years, and be really thankful for it. And I learned so much from it, and I wish I'd worried less and put my trust in God that he knew what was best for me. In those 3 years, it felt like I was walking around Edom. And I had no idea what the promised land looked like. But I know that God was taking some of the Egypt out of me. I know that now. He was teaching me to trust him. And there are lots of dreams I have for the future, lots of hopes. But when I think about it, what would happen if I got everything I wanted right now? Would I face battles that I wouldn't be able to fight? Or maybe it would make me corrupt or ungrateful. Because you can see what happens to a child when they're spoiled or where they get everything they want. It doesn't do their character any good. And now, even though I can still struggle with worry and anxiety, because God took me the long way around, I slowly began to put my trust in him and look forward with excitement rather than concern. Just as the Israelites eventually stopped looking back to Egypt and start looking forward to the promised land. And when I think about my future, I don't know if it's the same for you, it's always what I'm going to be doing or where I'm going to be going. But I wonder, when I look back on those 3 years, whether God was more concerned with who I was than what I was doing. And maybe this year, when we think about the future, maybe this last few months of the year, or maybe into next year, maybe we should start thinking a bit more about who do we want to be? Who does God want to make us? And I'm not saying that we shouldn't think about the what or the where, because they're still really important. But maybe we should be thinking, who do we want to be? And ask God that he'll take you on that journey. Ask God that he'll take some of the Egypt out of you. And I want to encourage you that whatever journey you're facing in life, and you're asking God, why am I going this way? Why is it taking so long? Just remember that sometimes God takes us the long way round because he knows what we'd face if we went the quick way, and he wants to take some of the Egypt out of us. to God, the journey is just as important as the destination. And this leads to the next part of the story, the snake problem. And the Israelites are complaining against God, and by doing so, they're essentially saying that we know best. Then putting themselves in the place of God. It makes them come across like they know better than him. And I do this all the time, and it's not just complaining, but it's living my life in a way that I know is not what is best for me, and it's not what God had intended for me. And the Bible has a word for this. It's called sin. When we put our own needs and our own wants and desires above God's, just as the Israelites were doing at this point. And we might find God's response to the Israelites a little bit hard to swallow, because God's judgment for their disobedience is to send an infestation of snakes, and people are bitten and people die. And at times we can read some stories in the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, and find it really difficult to reconcile a God who is loving with one who is also just and one who judges. And it's often one of the barriers that people can have when they think about coming to faith. And we don't have a huge amount of time to go into this topic in lots of detail. You could probably preach a whole series on this alone. But if you'd like to read up on it, or you have some questions, philosophical or theological questions, I'd encourage you to read Tim Keller's book, The Reason for God. And it starts to tackle some of these issues and these questions. But I do want to say this. It is because God is loving that he is also a God who judges. And we've already heard today that when we look back in the news and we read what's going on in this world, we just read some terrible things. The abuse, terrorism, the refugee crisis, for example. And it's part of our nature to demand justice for those things. And we've seen it played out over this last few weeks. And I believe that nature comes from God. He too cannot let the abuse, the terror, or the tragedy slide, because he loves the abused, the terrorized, and the tragic. And it's because of God's loving nature that he is also a judge, not in spite of it. And we in the West, we can be prone to ask questions like, why would a loving God judge? But if you are a refugee, fleeing a regime that threatens to annihilate your family, or maybe you're a Christian who's seen your loved ones killed at the hands of ISIS, maybe you're more likely to ask the question, why doesn't God judge? And we must be careful that we don't let our Western perspective blind us to the bigger picture. Sin, if it goes unchecked, it can utterly ruin and destroy everything in its path. And it's like a virus that can utterly destroy humanity. And perhaps for the sake of the world and the sake of the Israelites themselves, God sent those snakes to say, enough is enough. You may only be complaining now, but if I do not do something about it, it will grow and it will destroy you from the inside out. And when we think of the most shocking of crimes, it often starts with one comparatively small thought or decision. But when sin gets a hold, if it is unchecked, it can grow and grow and grow. And there's another story in the Old Testament where there was a snake problem. And it can be found in Genesis 3 in the Garden of Eden. And it's in this story where sin first takes hold of mankind. And it's because of this story that we all have a snake problem. But they're not in our homes or in our garden. They're in our hearts. And I know there are bits of my heart that I find difficult to give back to God. It's like there's something in me that doesn't belong there. And perhaps some of us can even feel it. Maybe it's the guilt or the shame or just the knowledge that this is not who I was meant to be, or this is not who I want to be. There are some snakes running rampant in my heart. There's something in there that doesn't belong there. And this reminds me of when I was in New Zealand with my cousin. We were traveling from the north of the North Island down to the south of the South Island via the Shire, of course. Middle Earth gets quoted on this stage all the time, but I've been there, so whatever. And we're in this town called Rotorua. And among other things, Rotorua is well known for its luge run. And a luge run is a concrete track that runs from the top of a mountain to the bottom. And you're in this kind of type of go-kart. And my cousin Joe, he's a bit more competitive than I am. He was probably what you would describe as a bit of a lad. And you may be surprised to hear that I'm not actually that much of a lad. I'm not very laddy. I'm a bit more chilled out and a little less competitive than he is. And he's determined to win this race. And he's speeding down this mountain. And about halfway down, you get to this jump. And it's one of these jumps that kind of, it hurts when you land. It's pretty big. And Joe, he's first. So he goes down this this loose track, goes over this jump, gets lots of air. And he wants to see me do the same jump. So he turns around as he's going down this mountain to watch me do it. And I do the jump, get loads of air, obviously. And then Joe starts to look back down the mountain again and realizes that his luge has veered half off the track and half on. So he's half on the grass and half on the concrete. And he's just wearing shorts and T-shirt, and he's trying to get his luge back in control, but he flips. And he slides down this concrete track, and I've seen everything, and it was absolutely hilarious. And I go past in hysterics. It was brilliant. So I wait for him to get to the bottom, and he makes his way down, and I see the damage. And he's cut all the side of his hand, and all the skin on the left side of his leg is completely gone. Yeah, bad. I feel guilty for laughing. And even though he got patched up and we went on our way, and even though Joe was with me for those next 2 or 3 days, he did nearly all the things that I did. He either wasn't able to completely enjoy it because he had this problem until he had help. And we did some amazing things. We went blackwater rafting, we got to swim in amazing lakes, and we even walked over Mount Doom, reference number 2. But Joe either wasn't able to do it as much as I wasn't able to do it, or he wasn't able to enjoy it as much as I had, because he had this problem. He had this pain in his leg. It was sore and it was painful. And then one evening in the middle of the night, he comes into my room in a complete panic. Joel, this is how he speaks. Joel, I'm really, really cold, but I'm really, really sweaty. And now I'm really, really hot. This doesn't normally happen, Joel. Can you help me? Please, please. Can you take me to the hospital? And I do what any loving cousin would do and chuck him the car keys, tell him to go on his own and fall back to sleep. So Joe goes to the hospital where I'm not painting myself in a good light here, am I, actually? Yeah. Oh, well. Joe drives to the hospital and he finds out that his leg is infected. And there was something in him that didn't belong there. There was something that was holding him back from this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And it's a bit like the snakes in that Israelite camp, and a bit like the snakes in our heart. They do not belong there. They take away life and they hold us back. So what's the solution? How did God deal with the snakes in the camp in Israel? And how can we use this story to help us deal with some of the snakes in our own hearts? And the snake problem, it's a problem throughout the Bible. It doesn't go away. And in fact, the Bible is essentially a book that details how God deals with the snake problem. And when the Israelites are bitten in this story, God tells Moses to build a bronze snake. And then when the Israelites look at it, they're healed. And then there's one mention of this story, this bronze serpent story in the New Testament that I want to talk about now. And it's called, it's in John 3, and it involves a man called Nicodemus. And Nicodemus was a Pharisee. And Pharisees had kind of, they were religious leaders at that time, at the time of Jesus. And Nicodemus is described as a leader of the Jews. So they were very well respected. And they kind of put it on themselves to challenge the claims that Jesus was making about himself. And kind of in the Bible depicted as opponents to Jesus. And throughout the book of John, John uses this imagery of light and dark to kind of paint a picture of good and evil. And Nicodemus is described as going to see Jesus in the middle of the night. And most commentaries believe that that's John trying to paint a picture of the state of Nicodemus's heart at that point. But unlike most Pharisees, Nicodemus understood that Jesus must have been from God because of the things he was doing and the things that he was saying. And he even describes Jesus as a teacher. And Jesus' response to Nicodemus is one of those responses that it happens occasionally in the New Testament where the thing the person's just said and then Jesus' answer isn't really related, but it's exactly what that person needs to hear. And Jesus says to Nicodemus that no one can see the kingdom of heaven unless they are born again. And it's where we get that term born again Christian from. And the resulting conversation between the two men is Jesus trying to explain what he means by being born again, and Nicodemus being very confused with the whole concept. And then it concludes with Jesus saying this: just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes may have eternal life in him. And I know that was an extremely brief description of this encounter, and feel free to read it in more detail later. But I think essentially what Jesus is trying to say is this: Nicodemus thinks that Jesus is a teacher, but that is only partly true. Jesus at his core didn't come to teach, although he clearly did do that. Jesus came to save. And just in the same way the Israelites looked at that bronze snake that wasn't going to teach them anything, Jesus is saying to Nicodemus, I have come to save you. I'm the solution. You don't need more teaching to be saved. You need to be born again. Just like the Israelites were given new life when they looked at that bronze snake, so have we. When we look to Jesus on the cross, we're born again. We have new life. But it's not the poison from the snakes that's killing us. It's our sin. Just imagine how Nicodemus would have felt as he hears these words from Jesus. Nicodemus knew that he was that Jesus was a teacher. He says it in verse 2. But Jesus is so much more than that. And what he's saying to Nicodemus is exactly what Nicodemus needed to hear. And by referring to this snake story, what is one of the things is Jesus trying to do? And perhaps a better way of putting it is this. If on a Sunday we got a pole of a bronze snake, put it on the stage and asked it to preach to us for 30 minutes, what would that teach us? Apart from maybe that hearing Andy Tilsley on a regular basis isn't such a bad thing after all. He's not here, so I can say anything I want. It will teach you nothing. What Jesus is saying to Nicodemus isn't that he isn't a teacher, because he clearly was. What he's saying is that Jesus' primary purpose was not as a teacher, but as a saviour. And C.S. Lewis says this, "I'm trying to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about him being a great moral teacher, great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to." And you can almost imagine C.S. Lewis writing this with Nicodemus in mind. Jesus didn't come just to teach. His primary purpose was as a saviour. And perhaps Nicodemus thought that getting more teaching or living a perfectly moral life would help him be saved, or would save him. But we all have mess in our lives. We all have a snake problem, every one of us. And we all need the solution. And for the Israelites in this story, it was looking at the bronze snake. But for us, it's looking to Jesus. And I think one of the reasons why Nicodemus would have found this whole concept difficult to understand was simply because of who he was. Because to most people, he'd be doing really, really well. He would have been well respected. He would have been influential, probably quite well off. He would have known the scriptures inside out. He would have tried to live a perfectly moral life. So for Jesus to then come along and say that to you, Nicodemus, none of that's going to save you. And in the eyes of God, you're in the same boat as everyone else. That's going to be quite hard for him to hear or even comprehend. And it's like when you prepare really hard for an English test at school. You read the book cover to cover. You write the little pencil notes in the margins. And then you have your friend who just watches the film the night before. And then you do your test and the results come back and you've got the same marks. Who's going to be more pleased about that? Even if you both got full marks, the person who did all that work, did all the revision, is going to be slightly annoyed that the person who did absolutely no work got the same marks as him. And the person who watched the film is obviously going to be thrilled. And Nicodemus is like the one who revised. And to Nicodemus, maybe the sinners or the losers of society are the ones who didn't. So you can now see why Nicodemus may have found this concept difficult to understand. But the snakes wouldn't have cared who was rich or poor, sick or healthy. They would have taken a bite out of anyone. And as a result, all of the Israelites would have needed to look to the bronze snake. And we all need to look to the cross. Rich or poor, sick or healthy, we all need to be born again, whether it's someone as high up in society like Nicodemus or someone as low as Andy Tuck. We all need to be born again. We all need the solution to the snake problem. And I want to end with three application points. And the first one is this. Recognize the snake problem. Because there's a tendency in our lives to either dumb down the seriousness of sin, or say that it's not important, or that we'll deal with it later, or maybe we refuse to acknowledge that we need to be forgiven. But we should respond like the Israelites respond. They go back to God and say, "We've sinned. Help us, God." They don't turn their back on him, they run to him. And that's how we should respond. The Israelites knew that the only thing that was going to save them was going to God. And it's the same with us. Sin, if it goes unchecked, it can grow and grow and grow. And whether you've been a follower of Jesus for years, or maybe this is all new to you, recognize the problem. And the second point is look to the solution. And we can often try to look to other things, maybe money or work or relationships. But there's only one person that can save us from the snake problem in our hearts, and it's Jesus. It's looking to Jesus. Because when he died on the cross, he took the snake problem onto himself. God saw all of the sin in this world, what had been and what will be. And instead of judgment coming onto us, Jesus took our sin onto himself. And as a result, the judgment of God fell onto him. He took it because he loves us. And all we need to do is look. Look to Jesus. And did you wonder why Moses used, or why God asked Moses to use a bronze snake for the Israelites? It sounds a bit strange. It sounds a bit kind of at odds with what we think about snakes in the Bible, or even just that it's the kind of the things that were causing the problem in the first place. But I believe that why God did that, because it's a beautiful analogy for the cross. Because it wasn't just Jesus who died on that cross, but it was our sin along with him. And when the Israelites looked at that bronze snake, they saw an image of what had tried to destroy them. And when we look to the cross, we not only see our Savior, we not only see Jesus, but we see the thing that tried to destroy us too, being put to death. And it's our faith in him that saves us. Not trying to live a perfectly moral life like Nicodemus, because we can never do it. The snake problem wouldn't go away. We can't deal with it on our own. But it's not the strength of our faith that saves us. It's the strength of the one we put our faith in. And there may have been some Israelites in that camp who heard of this bronze snake and would have had a huge amount of faith straight away. They may have thought, yeah, this is definitely from God. I know that when I look to that bronze snake, I'm going to be healed. And they look and they'd be healed. But then there may be others who were a bit more pessimistic. Maybe they heard it a bit like how we read it. A snake? Really? A bronze snake? That's going to save me? And maybe they looked at other things, but nothing had solved the problem. And then they look and they're healed in just the same way. And the reaction of the two would be the same. Complete and utter joy. It's not the strength of our faith that saves us. It's the strength of the one we put our faith in. And once my cousin Joe had been to hospital to sort his leg out, he was fine. He was treated properly. He got some tablets. He was back to normal. And the best thing was that the thing we enjoyed most about that holiday happened after he got help and when he was better. And we got to kayak through this fjord called Milford Sound. I think there'll be a picture of it. It was literally the best thing I've ever done. It was amazing. And the great thing was that Joe wasn't only able to do it, but he was able to fully appreciate it and fully enjoy it because he had a solution to the problem. He had help. He had a cure. And sometimes we can go through life feeling like we're infected, feeling like we've been bitten by a snake. There's something in us that doesn't belong there. And it's stopping us from living life to the full, how life should be lived and how God intended our lives to be lived. And Tim Keller, he sums up the problem and the solution like this. The gospel is this. We are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared believe. Yet at the very same time, we are more loved and accepted in Christ Jesus than we ever dared hope. The solution to the problem is this. Look to Jesus. And the final point is pretty simple. It's persevere. It's essentially don't stop doing the first two points. Be wary of the snake problem and keep looking to the solution. And I recently read an article that said that the UK were experimenting with electric roads that would wirelessly recharge electric cars as they drive, so you don't have to stop off and recharge. In some way, God does that with us. He gives us the strength to keep going. His Spirit gives us the strength to keep persevering. And if you're a follower of Jesus, keep looking to Jesus. And what's interesting is that the verse that immediately follows this meeting between Jesus and Nicodemus is probably the most famous verse in the whole of the Bible. John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have eternal life. And a better translation from the original Greek word of that word, whoever, is whoever keeps on believing or whoever keeps on going. And sometimes we can feel like life is tough and we can feel like God is taking us the long way round. But keep going. Keep persevering. God might be sparing you from battles that you cannot win. And maybe you've not reached the promised land yet. But maybe God's dealing with some of the snake problem in your heart. Maybe he's taking some of the Egypt out of you. And only a few of those Israelites ever made it to the promised land. They're the ones who persevered. They're the ones that kept going. But maybe you've never called yourself a follower of Jesus. But maybe you feel like, maybe there's some snakes running around in my heart and you've not yet found a solution. My suggestion is this. Look to Jesus. And there'll be a prayer team at the end, at the front of the stage, if you'd like prayer. Or just to talk, they'd love to do that. But the Israelites, they go on to reach the promised land. And that's not the last we hear of Nicodemus either. He was actually one of the men that prepared Jesus' body for burial. And it's pretty safe to assume that Nicodemus becomes a follower of Jesus. Because meeting Jesus had a profound effect on his life, like it has on mine. So recognize the problem and look to the solution. If we stand, I'll pray. And then the worship team will sing us a song. Jesus, thank you that you are the solution. Thank you that all we need to do is have faith and look to you. Thank you that you took the snake problem onto your own shoulders. You took our sin and died on a cross for us, that we can be born again and have new life. I pray that we would keep looking to you in everything, even when we feel like you're taking us the long way around. Help us to trust you in those moments especially. Amen.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.